for the possibility to speak here. So this is joint work with Alan McIntosh and Pierre Portal. It's available in the archive, and it has just recently been accepted for publication in the Journal of Functional Analysis. So the basic setup is the following. Consider the L divergence form second order operator bounded measurable coefficients, so the of the form displayed. So A is here a matrix valued L infinity function. And moreover, we assume this sort of standard ellipticity condition, the boundedness of the real part of the matrix uniformly from below. And now for the script Y, some function space on Rn, suppose for the moment that this following type of condition is satisfied, then we will later consider this for some concrete function spaces. So there is a whole bunch of resolvents of L and associated operators with the square root of the negative Laplacian on one or the other side or on both sides, and now assume for the moment that this whole set of operators is uniformly bounded as operators acting on the function space Y. And now indeed this condition is satisfied, at least in the case if Y is the Hilbert space L2, so then this ellipticity condition implies this resolvent boundedness. But in general, provided that this resolvent boundedness holds, then it follows in particular that the spectrum of the operator is contained in some sector of the complex plane. I don't know if anything is... The sector is something like some set of this form. And then it is possible to define functions of L, so the action of a holomorphic function to sort of plug the operator here, the functional calculus by this extended Dunford-Reese calculus we integrate. If the function is holomorphic in a slightly larger sector, then one takes a path here which stays inside the sector of holomorphicity and goes around the spectrum of the operator. And now the questions we are interested in deal with the boundedness of this type of operators. So for still being in the Hilbert space L2, the famous Kato conjecture is the fact that this square root of L, which can be defined by the previous formula with some limiting procedure, that this is an unbounded operator, but how unbounded it is, the conjecture says that it would have the same domain as the gradient, and moreover satisfy the norm comparability with the gradient of U. And nowadays this is a theorem proved by several people, published in the Annals of Mathematics 2002, that from the assumptions that I had on the first slide, this ellipticity condition implies not only the boundedness of the resolvents, but in fact it implies the boundedness of all these holomorphic functions. So these give bounded operators on the space Y, which is now the Hilbert space, and moreover this square root estimate is satisfied. But so far everything was Hilbert space, and now to go to the towards the title of the talk. So what about the Banach spaces LP on Rn? And now that once one takes this step, one could even go one step further. So what about the Banach spaces LP on Rn and with values in X, which is yet another Banach space? Well, first some general remarks. For quite general function spaces, why? I don't want to say exactly how general, but in any case, quite generally, it is true that this functional calculus will imply this resolvent boundedness conditions. So this cal was the functional calculus boundedness, and BD bounded was the resolvent boundedness condition. But on the other hand, there exist some counterexamples, at least for n sufficiently, so in sufficiently big dimension Rn, that if p is not equal to 2, the ellipticity condition need not imply the resolvent boundedness condition. And then, a fortiori, it does not need to imply the functional calculus. So in this sense, it seems first that there is not much hope to go beyond L2, but now let's cheat a little bit and assume that we were already able to go halfway up the mountain, so let's see if we can do the rest. So we make this resolvent boundedness condition as an assumption. And in fact, I have made it even a little bit stronger assumption. Originally there was the word uniformly bounded, and now there is the mysterious letter R, which I will explain on the next slide to those who are not familiar with this notion. So this is I make even a little bit stronger assumption than just the uniform boundedness. Though one should make the remark that in the original L2 setting, we are still, it is actually equivalent, but for more general, for non-Hilbertian spaces, it's even a stronger assumption. And yet another remark that it's again quite general, it is a necessary condition, so it's something quite generally, it is true that such an R-boundedness condition is necessary to get the functional calculus, and it's a non-trivial thing to ask whether the converse is true. So what is the mysterious R-boundedness? It's a probabilistic notion. We require the sequence of independent random signs on some probability space omega. So take the values plus 1 and minus 1 with equal probability 1/2. This definition of R-boundedness was made explicit in a paper of Bergson and Gillespie in 1994, although one can trace back implicit occurrences of this ideas somewhat further in the history. So it's a property of a set of bounded linear operators on a Banach space, and we require such a uniform estimate that there should exist one finite constant C such that for any natural number and any number of vectors from the Banach space and any choice of the same number of operators from the collection, it should be true that one can sort of pull out the operator coefficients from such a random sum. And one can see that just with K, the capital K equal to 1, this is the condition of uniform boundedness. And in general, in a Hilbert space, it's equivalent, but otherwise it's a more complicated notion or a stronger notion. It is not just a property of the individual operators, but it's somehow a collective property of how they work together. And in the last, maybe at this point one could say in the last 10 years, 5-10 years, it has been in several results of vector-valued harmonic analysis, the following rule of thumb has been developed that typically in order to be able to get analogs of classical theorems, one needs to replace some conditions of uniform boundedness by R-boundedness. Well, in the classical setting it would be equivalent, but in a more complicated setting one has to, they are two different things, and usually one needs this stronger notion. Okay, with all this said, I'm able to state the kind of theorem we were able to prove in this setting. So remember that we are looking for the square root estimate of or functions of the elliptic operator L, but now acting on LP, on the LP space of functions on Rn and with values in some Banach space X. And so now we require two different things about this Banach space X. The first one is the UMD property, which is sort of the standard notion in to be able to do anything in the vector-valued harmonic analysis. By definition, it means the unconditionality of martingale differences, which is a probabilistic notion. Maybe for analysts it's more convenient to say that it's equivalent to the boundedness of the Hilbert transform on L2 with values in X. So the Hilbert transform is defined by the same formal expression, the singular integral, but then just one integrates vector-valued functions in the same sense of Bochner. And we also needed another condition, which at this point remains a little bit mysterious, but I will show in the end that we could verify it in many concrete cases, but we could not. It would be actually a conjecture that every UMD space satisfies this RMF property, but at the present stage of understanding, we don't know if this is true. Still, we were able to check that sort of for most of the concrete examples of UMD spaces that are known, this RMF property, the Rademacher maximal function property, is satisfied. And now for this theorem, we require that it is true for X and the dual of X. Also, we don't know if this is a self-dual property, so this is the reason why one has to make it for both X and X star. Okay, so with this assumption on the Banach space X, also one could think of just a scalar-valued situation. If X is complex numbers, already then there is some interest in this theorem because we have different values of P than just the P equals 2, and then one can forget about the first two assumptions, so they do hold for the complex numbers. So now if the ellipticity condition from the first slide is satisfied, and moreover this R-boundedness condition of the resolvents is satisfied in the LP space, and not just one LP space but for all LP spaces in some open interval, then also the functional calculus is true in the same open range of spaces. So this is another thing that one would like to polish. It would be nice to be able to make this statement in just a fixed function space, but unfortunately we were not able to do this, so we sort of require that in order to make the proof we need some space around the exponent P, that we need the condition sort of also for P plus epsilon and P minus epsilon. But one should remark that it's not necessary that the exponent 2 be included in this range. It can be just any P minus and P plus, P minus smaller than P plus, in order to have something non-trivial but otherwise arbitrary. And yeah, a little bit comment on the proof. I already mentioned that UMD is a sort of standard assumption in this kind of vector-valued harmonic analysis context, but also it is quite easy to see that in this case it is necessary to make this assumption. Okay, I have a small, there is a misprint in the, or something missing in the slide, so here should be a square root around the minus Laplacian. So in the case when the coefficient matrix is just the identity matrix, then the operator L reduces to the negative Laplacian, and then the square root estimate, where I forgot the square root, says that the square root of the negative Laplacian is non-comparable to the gradient of U in LP, which is basically saying that the Riesz transforms are bounded in this space, and this is equivalent to the, it's well known that this is equivalent to the UMD property. So the UMD is a necessary condition. The RMF is more like a technical feature. And now for the actual proof, it's more inspired by not so much by the original proof of the Kato conjecture directly, but by a more recent development of these ideas by Andreas Axelsson, Stephen Keith, and Alan McIntosh, published in Inventiones, where they use the related first-order matrix-valued operator, which is actually two of them, two first-order factorizations of the second-order operator L. So first this gamma and gamma star will appear later on, and this pi is the sum of the two, and now the pi A and pi tilde A are sort of perturbed versions of this operator pi. I put the A either in this position before the divergence or in this position after the gradient. And if one computes the squares of these two matrices, one sees that in both cases the original operator L minus divergence A gradient will appear in the first place. So in this sense, these can be viewed as sort of factorizations of the original operator. One, of course, one gets something extra also. And why it's useful to consider this operator? Well, in order to one is interested in the square root estimate, which at least formally, putting this one to be some V, writing the square root of L to the other side, it means that this operator should be bounded and also bounded from below. This is kind of a Riesz transform associated to the operator L. But one sees that this one is not a function of L in any reasonable sense. But on the other hand, it is in some sense a function of this operator pi A, namely the signum function, which is here the I think of signum as being z divided by the square root of z squared. So it is a holomorphic function in such a double sector, which take the value plus one here and minus one here, but because the two components are disconnected, so it's a holomorphic function in such a double sector. And if I evaluate this function, well, here it's sort of a formal computation which can be made precise, but the signum function of this matrix operator pi A will be such a matrix, and it contains exactly this Riesz transform in this corner. So if one is able to prove this kind of functional calculus estimate, then in particular it implies the functional calculus of L and also the square root estimate. So this is the motivation for the first order operator. Now, to actually prove the functional calculus, again by abstract reasons, it's equivalent to prove sort of quadratic estimates. The quadratic is now in quotations because there is not really anything explicitly quadratic in the general situation, but it reduces to something quadratic in the L2 case. Now the quadratic really means that there is the random signs and the expectation. It's just in the very special case that there is explicitly something quadratic. But in any case, the estimate which is needed is sort of an abstract little Wood-Paley inequality related to approximations of the identity or a resolution of the identity derived from the operator pi A, and by some algebra it is sufficient to prove it in the range of this operator gamma and something similar in the range of gamma star and various different estimates which have a similar structure. So it basically suffices to concentrate on this estimate star. Okay, I just introduced some notation. There are approximations of the identity in the harmonic and dyadic world, and we need both of them, and the philosophy is that they are essentially the same. And then one needs to consider the principal part, which is sort of the T of one, the same philosophy as the T of one theorem. And then this operator QTA is split into various parts. Maybe it's not worth to pay too much attention into the exact form because I don't have time to discuss it in too much detail. But there is the first is something one could call the high frequency part, which is actually more or less it's an essentially algebraic reason why this one will be handled. The same thing is we would call the off diagonal part, which is handled by estimates like Poincaré's inequality and Fourier multipliers, which are relatively standard tools also in the vector valued context studied in the last 5-10 years. And then there is the martingale part, which is already quite a bit more tricky, or at least it was for us took some time to figure out how to handle it, and this is something where one had to use the UMD condition explicitly, so really to construct some auxiliary martingale which gives the desired estimate. And yeah, so it's basically this first factor here is relatively easy to get rid of, and then one needs to prove this sort of randomized or quadratic estimate which was done by the martingale methods. And then finally there remains the principal part, and in order to handle this one needed to our knowledge a new version of a Carlesson type inequality, and also in the vector valued setting a new maximal function if one does it for LP with scalar valued functions. Well, then the Carlesson inequality is still new. The maximal function reduces to the classical one. So this is, the maximal function is standard in the scalar valued case, but the Carlesson inequality is still something apparently new, I think. So this is our LP version. So here is, I stated for the scalar valued functions first. So I want to estimate the LP norm of such a quadratic expression. So here are the averages of U on dyadic cubes, or the conditional expectations for dyadic filtrations, multiplied point-wise by a sequence of functions B2K. And this one is dominated by, we want to have the domination by the LP norm of U and then some quantity related to the sequence of functions B, and this kind of a Carlesson P plus epsilon quantity will do. And you can see if P equals 2, it's basically the classical Carlesson type quantity, because the exponent P over 2 will be just 1. But otherwise, it's a mixed L2 LP norm kind of condition, so that vertically there is the L2 sum, little L2 sum in this case, because it's a discrete version, and then there is the, on the cube, there is the LP integral of this little L2 sum. And by the way, one can, you might wonder why is the epsilon, or what does the epsilon do, so there is no epsilon in the original, in the classical. And in fact, we can also, if P is between 1 and 2, including 2, then it is possible to do it with epsilon equal to 0. I don't know. I mean, it would be actually quite nice to have it for epsilon equal to 0 for all P, because this would allow us to remove the assumption that we need the resolvent conditions in an open range of exponents. This epsilon is the reason for the requirement of epsilon in the assumptions of the theorem. Yeah, this is just noting that it's the Carlesson 2 is the classical Carlesson 1. And now, how does this change in the vector valued setting? Well, basically once we were able to prove this, it was not so difficult to just imitate the proof and see what happens in the vector valued setting, except for the fact that then we needed a version of the maximal function of vector valued functions which we did not encounter before. So this is the Rademacher maximal function that I mentioned in the early part of the talk. So it's now, well, it's a version of the dyadic maximal function, one could say. In the dyadic maximal function, one would take the sup of the absolute values or the norms of these dyadic averages. But now this is the same philosophy, the uniform bound has to be replaced by an R bound. You might ask, what is the R bound of, these are vectors in the Banach space X, not in an operator space. So here is implicitly the identification that X can be identified isometrically with bounded linear operators from complex numbers to X. And then one can compute the R bound in the usual way. And for Banach space experts, I can mention that again one can take epsilon equal to zero if X has type P. And this is the, so the RMF property is exactly the boundedness of the Rademacher maximal function for one P or for all P. And as I said, we don't precisely understand this condition. We have some sufficient conditions. If X has type 2, or if it's a UMD function lattice, which is quite important for applications. So if it is a Banach space, it has the UMD property, and moreover, it is a, so it's not just an abstract Banach space, but it's a Banach space consisting of functions and with such a norm that it is a lattice. And also actually in a more complicated, if it's a non-commutative LP space, then still it satisfies the property. And it's, there is no hope to prove it in a general Banach space. We have a counterexample to show that the little L1 does not have this property. But it is open. It could be, there is still a good hope that every UMD space could have the property. Or in fact, there is no reason so far why it couldn't even be true for every uniformly convex space. But there are, these are questions that we have not yet been able to answer. And I think I will stop here.